Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote an essay entitled Life Without Principle, in which he implied that a life without principle was actually no life at all. Well, if there is a life in our generations living today that embodies the principle of life with principle, it would be that of our speaker tonight, Thomas S. Soz. If you have the opportunity to meet Dr. Soz and shake his hand during the course of the weekend, I advise it. Because one of these days when the history of this movement is written and the history of how liberty was achieved is written, you're going to want to be able to tell your friends and your children and your grandchildren that you met one of the real heroes of this movement, one of the true giants. It is a true honor that he accepted to be our keynote speaker at our five-year anniversary banquet. Dr. Soz is professor of psychiatry emeritus at State University of New York Health Science Center in Syracuse, New York, where he has taught since 1956. He is the author of over 600 articles, book chapters, book reviews, and newspaper columns. He graduated with honors in physics and received his MD degree from the University of Cincinnati. The New England Journal of Medicine called him, quote, a man of great erudition with impeccable training. He is among the rare persons who call the shots exactly as they see them. He is the author of many books, including The Myth of Mental Illness, Foundations of a Theory of Personal Conduct, Psychiatric Justice, Ceremonial Chemistry, The Ritual Persecution of Drugs, Addicts, and Pushers, Schizophrenia, The Sacred Symbol of Psychiatry, The Myth of Psychotherapy, Mental Healing is Religion, Rhetoric, and Repression, The Untamed Tongue, A Dissenting Dictionary, Our Right to Drugs, The Case for a Free Market, and his latest contribution, Cruel Compassion. He is also the recipient of numerous awards, among which are the Ralph Kara Award from the American Civil Liberties Union, the New York chapter, the annual Civil Liberties Lectureship at Cornell Law School, the Holmes Munsterberg Award from the International Commission for Human Rights, and the Noel Buxton Lectureship at the University of Essex in Colchester, England. When I was compiling quotes for a series of healthcare articles that we ran in Freedom Daily, most of those quotes came from articles that had appeared in the Freeman magazine published in the 1950s. And in those articles, the authors, writing from a free market perspective, of course, were talking about the healthcare threat that was coming from the leftists, those that were trying to use government to take over the healthcare system, to manage and control this vitally important part of our lives. This was back in the 1950s. Again, the essays appeared in the 60s, then again in the 70s. So anyone that thinks that this assault is dead had better place things in perspective. The battle will continue. And we were fortunate to have Dr. Soz, a hero not only for libertarians, but also for those in the psychiatry profession, address us tonight on healthcare, the latest excuse for the Leviathan. Dr. Soz.
Mr. Hornberger, friends, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for this extremely generous introduction. It is my honor and my pleasure to be here, and I thank you for asking me to perform this service, this honor. I will forego the obligatory humor at the beginning, but not quite. Much of what I will say is actually will illustrate a remark that Will Rogers made. Will Rogers said, "I don't have to make any jokes every time Congress passes a law. It's a joke." And some of the things which I will be mentioning to you will be the kind of legislation that to which this applies. Also, I might say that after having the pleasure of hearing Joe Sobrant's address at lunch, it occurred to me to say, with all modesty, that this is really a footnote. What I'm going to tell you is a footnote to the general theme that he has outlined, and which has also intrigued me, that really we don't have the kind of constitutional government that the founders dreamed of, but instead we have a different kind of government, and in some ways what kind of government we have is what I will be talking about. Now, this year also happens to be the 50th anniversary of the publication of Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. And it seemed to me that, I would get started with that watershed. And between the publication of that book and the unraveling of the Soviet Union, we have now come to a situation where, which was in some ways always true in this country, but it is now quite obvious that no respectable individual defends socialism or communism as an effective economic policy. No one will say, as whoever it was, Brezhnev, that we will overtake you, we will have better better consumer economy than you do. No one says that. But in point of fact, in the United States, going quite far back, for reasons which are historical and cultural and perhaps unknowable, the word socialism has early acquired a negative connotation. So there are very few people who call themselves socialists, much less communists. But they don't have to, because in this country, the notion of protection, particularly protection from destitution and disease, has really replaced the need for socialism. And as I see it, really, the whole healthcare rhetoric is socialist rhetoric in terms of disease treatment and so forth. Now, I'll be obviously saying much more about that. Now, when we talk about the government taking a role in protecting people from disease, the first thing I want to mention that the very concept of disease is not as simple as it may seem. And its meaning has changed. Now, what is a disease? You might all think you know what a disease is, and of course you do, but you don't. Because those of you who think of this in a kind of a personal and down-to-earth way, mainly about yourself, will think that a disease is something, first of all, that you don't want. You rather have without, be without. Secondly, that it is something that happens to you. Something like leukemia or diabetes or arthritis. I mean, this is not something that you want. And fourthly, it is something which one can genuinely, philosophically say is not a part of you. In other words, if you have, let's say, tuberculosis or you have a sore throat, now, or for this week, next week, when you haven't got it, you will still be you. It's not a part of you. Now, this is in some ways, the last but not least, there is a scientific dimension of it, which is very important, and which again, you don't have to be a physician or in any way a professional person to realize that modern medicine is relatively recent, going really only back to about the middle, the second half of the 19th century, and depends really on the development of modern medical technology, mainly the autopsy, tissue staining, pathology, and then the more sophisticated techniques of examining the body. So that I have always thought that the analogy between the gold standard in economic affairs and pathological lesions in medicine make a very nice analogy. That is, diseases are not something that doctors make up. It is something that they find, and they typically found it in dead bodies. And how do you know that somebody has a disease, that somebody dies, and the pathologist examines the liver, the kidney, the lungs, and so on, and they find if someone has pulmonary tuberculosis, that their lung looks different from a normal lung, and so on. It's that simple. And sometimes, of course, there are new diseases, like AIDS, Legionnaires, and so on, but these are all found by pathologists on people who are, quote, sick in some ways, but the clinical diagnosis is always secondary, is always trumped by the pathological diagnosis, as it's said in medicine. Now, this was pretty much the case until, certainly, even when I went to medical school, which was more than 50 years ago. But this has changed, really, since then, quite rapidly. This was, first of all, not always true, and as I said, I'm not going to be saying much. This was never true of psychiatry, because psychiatrists always were the medical specialists who treated diseases which did not exist, in the sense that pathologists never saw them. Pathologists, going back to psychiatry, pathologists never saw madness. They had pathologists in mental hospitals, they kept looking for diseases, and every once in a while they did find the diseases historically, the most important example being neurosyphilis. Now, neurosyphilis, as you know, is a pretty bad thing. And if you have neurosyphilis, after a while, you don't act normally, quote. So that causes madness. And then, of course, the pathologists found this. Then this became, quote, a disease. Now, one of the things which happens, and I just want to get this out of the way, is that when a pathologist finds a disease, it's no longer a mental disease. Then it's a real disease. It's a brain disease. And neurosyphilis still exists. It's very rare now, after the use of penicillin, but it still exists. But psychiatrists have nothing to do with it. If somebody has neurosyphilis now, it's treated by neurologists or specialists in infectious diseases with antibiotics. It's not a psychiatric disease. Now, the reason why this is important is because from a psychiatric basis, with which you are more or less familiar, in our day, we have developed to a point where diseases are no longer defined by pathologists, but are defined essentially by a political process. And I will illustrate that as I go on. Of which, generally speaking, diseases are things which are unwanted behaviors. Now, who are they unwanted by? They may be unwanted by the individual himself, in which case he or she may call it a disease, or they may be unwanted by psychiatrists, or most typically by society, the authorities of the state. Of which the best example, of course, is, quote, drug abuse, substance abuse. But the important thing, I'll come back to that. Now, one more thing about disease. The entire healthcare debate is premised on an idea which is a wonderful idea, a very simple idea. There's only one thing wrong with it. It is totally fallacious. Now, let me tell you what that idea is, and I never see this mentioned. Again, it is something which, when I tell you, you will say, well, of course. But I never see this mentioned, and it is absolutely crucial. Now, the premise is that diseases require treatment. So the thing to do is avoid diseases so you don't need the treatment, which will then cost a lot of money to everybody, because obviously nobody pays for it anymore. You know, you pay for everybody else's disease except your own disease. So the thing to do is to prevent diseases. Sounds all right? No. Diseases don't require treatment. Diseases, that's why I define them, diseases are natural events, like oil in the ground. It's a phenomenon. Cancer of the colon. Now, oil in the ground doesn't need extracting. People want it extracted, assuming they have some use for it. So diseases don't require treatment. Some people want their diseases treated. Okay? And some people don't want their diseases treated. Now, you hear about how people shouldn't smoke, for example, I'll come back to that, because it will cost a great deal of money to treat it. Therefore, if you get lung cancer, I will have to pay for it, so you shouldn't smoke. Well, this has a certain rationale to it, given this socialist premise. There's only one thing wrong with it. There are all kinds of people with all kinds of diseases who don't want treatment. The relationship between disease and treatment is arbitrary. It's not logically if one then the other. A lot of people with diseases want treatment. A lot of people without any diseases want treatment. Used to be called hypochondriasis. Conversely, a lot of people with diseases don't want treatment. Now, who are some of the people with diseases who don't want treatment? Well, there are two huge groups. I could spend maybe, you know, we are gaining an hour tonight, so maybe I should spend that extra hour talking to you. One large group is called Christian Scientists. Now, when you hear about smokers being penalized for causing extra healthcare costs, do you ever hear about Christian Scientists being exempted from certain taxes? Because they don't utilize healthcare costs at all. Right? You're a Christian Scientist, it doesn't cost you anything. Taxpayer doesn't cost anything. Now, the other group, and I will perhaps say more about that, are so-called crazy people. Now, they don't, their cost, their healthcare cost, is astronomical as things now stand. But in point of fact, they have a characteristic. And that is, they don't want any treatment at all. I am talking about really mad people. When I talk about psychiatry, by the way, I should clarify it. I'm not talking about psychoanalysis, counseling. To me, psychiatry is one of two things, which is the way it was born and which is its backbone. It is locking up innocent people, called civil commitment, and excusing guilty people, called the insanity defense. That's what psychiatry is. In both cases, nowadays, generally you get locked up. Keep in mind someone like Hinckley. Hinckley did not say, I was sick. Hinckley wanted to plead guilty. Other people said he is sick. They are still treating him. They are working on his schizophrenia. Now you see, if you believe that, you'll believe anything. But nobody believes that. I think modern societies, especially this country, run on hypocrisy. Nobody believes any of this. Nobody believes that the war on drug works and so on, but there are reasons why this goes on. Now, the other group of people are, quotes, crazy people, who in current parlance, deeper goal parlance, suffer from denial. They are in denial. Now, what does that mean in denial? Denial means I don't want to see a doctor. Well, you would have thought this is a constitutional right. You don't have to see anybody you don't want to see. But no, if you don't want to see a doctor, then you certainly have to see a doctor. And that's going to be very expensive. So there are two ways in which healthcare costs are incurred. That you are asking for it, or that somebody else says you have to get some healthcare. And that's then going to cost money. Now, I prepared a fairly elaborate paper, but everybody tells me that I shouldn't read the paper. So I'm not going to do that, but I do have some quotes which I do want to use. Now, Mises correctly told us, and he was one of the first to really ride this point, it became one of his hobby horses, it seems to me, that one cannot make rational economic calculations in a socialist economy. That's pretty obvious that, you know, how do you know what people want when they don't have it? They can't see, I don't want this kind of raincoat, I want that kind of button, and so on, and somebody else tells you what there will be on the market. Now, if ever this was true of consumer goods, it seems to me that this is doubly true of medical services. Because there's absolutely no way of telling what kind of medical services the American people want. This, again, is so large a subject that I'm just going to do a very short shrift of it. First of all, an unknown number, an unknown percentage of people, but I think it's a very large percentage, now go to physicians for the simple reason of getting a prescription for a medicine, because in point of fact, all drugs, virtually all drugs that any intelligent person wants and needs are illegal. All of them. The only drugs which are not illegal, completely illegal, are the so-called over-the-counter drugs. But every effective drug, for example, if you have a bad sore throat and if you have sinusitis, you want an antibiotic, that's illegal. If you have to go to a doctor to get a prescription, that to me is analogous to having to go in the old days to some Soviet bureaucrats and having to get a permission to leave the country. Now you could say you have a right to leave the country. Well, of course, if mama and papa give you permission to leave it. Now you have access to this drug provided you produce the right kind of symptoms. So you have to lie and say what it is that you want. Now, the best example of which is the disease, and here is a disease, which is probably one of the most frequently used, I mean, I understand the most frequent drug is Zantac, is anti-acid drug, and so on. But in older days, and even now, these drugs are high on the list, is for a disease called insomnia. Now, it's one of the rules of medical licensure and medical practice in every state that a physician is not permitted to prescribe a drug, prescription drug, for a patient unless that patient is his personal patient, unless he has examined the patient and therefore made a diagnosis that this is a drug required. Now, how does a person, how does a physician make a diagnosis of insomnia? Here is this busy, here is this busy executive or housewife or whoever who has an appointment for 2 p.m., comes at 1:45, already, you know, has to sacrifice all kinds of other things he wants to do, in the physician's office. Maybe at 3:15 the physician will see him, by which time the physician is all worked up with a heavy schedule and the patient is all worked up. Now, how is the physician going to determine that this patient can't sleep? Then he goes home at 10 o'clock at night. It's a charade. But then you can get a prescription drug. Now, in the good old days, you could get barbiturates. Now, of course, you can no longer get barbiturates, because barbiturates are very useful. Besides sleeping for one night, you can sleep forever. And that you are not supposed to do. So it's really quite impossible to make that calculation. Secondly, it's impossible to make the calculation because physicians themselves talk people into all kinds of medical procedures, which are economically problematic, very complex, heart bypass, expensive things that you know. You have these statistics, how many of these things are performed so much more often here than in England or Canada or somewhere else. So in point of fact, again, this is for this audience, I mean, I am carrying in some ways calls to Newcastle, it's obvious that unless there was some other kind of arrangement, particularly complete access to drugs, and some very large measure of payment by patients, there would be no way of telling, there is no way of telling now how American citizens want to apportion their income into what is worth or how much is it worth when you're 80 years old to have some bone marrow transplant and this or that, if you have to pay for it, as compared to something else that you could do for your family and so on. But now that you don't have to pay for it, of course, this is a real seduction. I mean, go for it, because in some ways everybody feels, well, at least I can, you know, can sort of rip off the system. I can get all these things for nothing, all these treatments. Now, actually, let me quote you here something. Belatedly, pathologists, epidemiologists, real doctors, besides psychiatrists, are waking up to this. And here is a typical comment from an article in the New York Times about the problem of what is it that's going on medically in the country and how you cannot tell what's going on. Belatedly, physicians complain, and I'm quoting now from this article, data from current medical records, insurance claim forms, and pharmacy records are severely biased and therefore all but unusable. Doctors may write in the record or an insurance claim form that they are doing a PSA test, that's a prostate cancer test, because a man has prostate cancer even when he is perfectly healthy. It is impossible to judge the outcomes of a clinical interaction on the basis of the paperwork that is now done. So when physicians, epidemiologists, pathologists will look back 50 years from now at records now, they will have absolutely no way of telling what was going on as compared to 100 years ago or 80 years ago in terms of the incidence of syphilis or tuberculosis and so on. Now, actually, all of what I have told you are just symptoms of a general phenomenon that has preoccupied me for pretty nearly 40 years, or ever since I've thought of, you know, went to medical school, perhaps even before, and has, of course, occurred to other people too. And that is the therapeutization, the transformation of politics into healthcare in general terms. And I discovered a remarkably beautiful statement by the poet, who was, of course, much more than a poet, Winston Auden, who wrote the following. Now, listen carefully, because this really says it in a general way all, and then I will elaborate on it. What is peculiar, and I'm quoting, what is peculiar and novel to our age is that the principal goal of politics in every advanced society is not, strictly speaking, a political one. That is to say, it is not concerned with human beings as persons or citizens, but with human bodies. In all technologically advanced countries today, whatever political label they give themselves, their policies have essentially the same goal: to guarantee to every member of society, as a psychophysical organism, the right to physical and mental health. Now, this is now sort of taken as an elementary quote, right, that we have a right, and you know, the World Health Organization, the United Nations has this in its platform and so on. Well, back now to what is health? Well, one or two of the things which are defined as disease now are what used to be called bad habits. Now, bad habits, now, if they are medical, as I already indicated, are habits which may lead to disease and therefore cost the taxpayer money. Of which the two examples that I will use are smoking and obesity, overeating, whatever that is. But before I come to that, I have to make a comment about how medical costs are now defrayed, paid for, because that's the infrastructure for the problems. The problems are the solution. The solution is to have, quote, health insurance. Now, this whole thing, very much like psychiatry, one can't talk about, unless one talks, you know, excuse me, even though I do it with an accent, but one has to talk English about it. Now, health insurance is not health insurance. First of all, it's illness insurance. And secondly, it's not insurance at all. It's not insurance at all. Because insurance is something which a person buys for something, for an event, for a future event, from which he wants to protect himself, like his house burning down. Okay? Therefore, a homeowner's insurance does not pay for fixing the plumbing, or repainting the house, or changing the light bulb. Now, if you are on Medicare, like I am, you get a letter from the Medicare system, go and get your flu shot, it won't cost you anything. And so on. So the most trivial things are now paid for. That's not insurance. No insurance can do that. Secondly, what do you think would happen to the homeowner insurance industry if state legislatures compelled every such insurance company to insure homeowners for burning down their own house? Now, I kid you not. If you are in a group plan, the state legislatures many years ago have compelled insurance companies to insure on what they call on parity, that you don't get schizophrenia. I don't know how many of you wake up, go to bed at night worrying that you'll wake up with schizophrenia. Or that you'll wake up from a disease called substance abuse, called heroin addiction. Or even alcoholism. Is this something that you get? Or is this something that you do to yourself? This is why I said, emphasize the beginning. Now, these are things you do to yourself. And I'll come back to the two things, being overweight and smoking. Now, is it possible to be overweight unless you put more calories into your mouth than you use up? I mean, how many years of schooling do you need for this? Now, if you have to actually do this act, how can this be a disease? But wait until you see what I'm going to read to you from quotes. Now, smoking is the same thing. How can you have smoking disease if you don't smoke? By the way, all the psychiatric diseases, they are just more subtle. They are all in this class. Now, you might say some people who have, I don't know, agoraphobia, who are afraid to get into an elevator, really don't want to get in, really would like to get into an elevator. To which my answer is yes and no. If they really wanted to, they would get into it. That's another lecture. Because in point of fact, I learned this, I was very, very young. Let me tell you a little autobiographical vignette. I read this in Hungary when I was very young. And again, maybe I remember it because it just gelled with something. Because this was a very popular book in Europe, hardly known here, called The Story of San Michele by a physician named Axel Munthe, a Swedish physician. And this was an autobiographical. Anybody has ever heard of this book? One person. M-U-N-T-H-E. It's in a mass paperback in an English translation too. This was a man who lived, who was actually a contemporary of Charcot's, who was at his height around, you know, Freud studied with Charcot in the 1880s, 1890s. And there was very little, it might be worth going through this because it sort of gives you also an idea of what the distinction between medical disease and psychiatric disease is, really, in a very brutal kind of way. In the Nazi period, the same experiment sort of was repeated, that Bettelheim wrote about. But this is a story that Munthe tells. In, let's say, 1890, there were large madhouses, mental hospitals, so-called, insane asylums, in France, where Charcot in Paris and so on, where Charcot worked, and where this Axel Munthe, as a young physician, was a young physician. And, you know, medical diagnosis was in it in infancy. So if there was a, let's say, 30-year-old, typically very often these were women, who couldn't walk, well, physicians had no very good way of finding out why this woman couldn't walk, because either she didn't want to walk, so she didn't have to work on some farm or something, in other words, quotes hysteria, what they then call, or couldn't walk because she had multiple sclerosis, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, in other words, some neurological disease which paralyzed her. There was no CAT scan, none of this thing, but there was a diagnostic test, absolutely foolproof test. There would be 30 patients, let's say, all of none of whom could walk. And quite often in this derelict building, at 2 o'clock in the morning, somebody was smoking or something, and the building caught on fire. And 15 patients ran out, paralyzed patients, and were found on the lawn the next morning, you know, cavorting, and the other 15 were incinerated. Well, that was a differential diagnosis. So this sort of, you know, what does it mean that I can't and I don't want to? I mean, obviously, if this can be overcome by this kind of an experiment of nature, then you have an answer. Now compare this to one of the currently popular diseases, depression. Now I am not saying that depression doesn't exist. Obviously, a lot of people don't feel very happy. I mean, life is no bowl of cherries. I mean, why should anybody feel happy? Actually, if you go to museums and look at pre-17th century pictures, they are all, everybody's supposed to be depressed. That was, you know, mater dolorosa. You know, that was in some ways the view of life. That life is a tragic experience and people are sinful and do all kinds of things and they should suffer, and they should suffer in hell. And if you were virtuous, maybe you'll be happy in a life hereafter. But this idea of keep smiling and everything is fine here was a very modern idea. After all, your wife died every time she got pregnant, and, you know, you got sick. It was, you know, life was not very easy. Now, Parade magazine on September 19, as I was writing this just a few weeks ago, on the previous week, it had a long cover article with Tipper Gore about how depression is a disease that's treatable. And then a week later, there was a shorter piece in which this message was repeated, and the magazine reassured its readers, quotes, that you can find help for depression, and encouraged the reader to write to their depressed friends offering this sample letter form. Dear blank X, I care about you and I am concerned that you are not yourself lately. I don't like to see you unhappy. I hear depression is an illness with very effective treatment. And 2 weeks later, in a depression screening reminder, Parade repeated its recommendation that people go for, quotes, depression screening. It's like cancer screening, which last year saved 1,500 persons from suicide. again, suicide is not exactly my topic for tonight, but you realize, if you have any sense of history at all, that we are talking about the renaming of what used to be sins, often mortal sins, as diseases. Suicide was self-murder up until the 19th century. Exactly like abortion, adultery, fornication, all kinds of things, homosexuality, masturbation. These were all sins. Now, they are all mental diseases or mental or psychiatric treatments, if it's masturbation. Now, when I went to medical school, masturbation was still listed as the cause of schizophrenia. But none of this somehow makes any difference. Now, depression cannot be a disease. And the fact that somebody can do something about it that makes you better doesn't mean that it's a disease. It simply means that you can be made to feel better by all kinds of things. Smoking, sex, winning the lottery, and so on. All kinds, you know. Divorce. Now, one more point about how we pay for healthcare, which I forgot to mention when I mentioned the nonsense about insurance, first of all, which pays for trivial, which is not an insurance for catastrophic costs, but is some kind of social redistribution scheme, a scheme of socialized medicine, or redistribution of costs from one person to the other. The last thing, which of course is wrong with it, and this also is beginning to dawn on people, although it's not articulated, and that is that there is no healthcare crisis with any kind of proper use of English, in the sense that healthcare, certainly for those who can afford it and who can make use of it intelligently, has never been as good as it now is in this country and in many other advanced countries, for the simple reason why automobiles have never been as good, and airplanes have never been as good, and telephones have never been as good. I mean, it's obviously, I don't have to belabor that, it's better now. We have all kinds of diagnostic and therapeutic tools. Superior. So there's no crisis in that sense. I mean, and even poor people, as economists point out, not only do the poor person live better now than the richest person did 300 years ago, but even a poor person, a penniless, homeless person who goes to, who has a bleeding peptic ulcer or a fractured leg, who goes to Bellevue emergency room, gets better care than the King of England got 300 years ago. Again, because, well, it's obvious. Now, what is the crisis? Well, you're damn right there is a crisis. The crisis is that healthcare has become, for entirely tax-related reasons, which all of you know much more about than I do, related to employment. Now, insofar as there is insecurity of employment, that's translated into insecurity of healthcare. What's the answer? Why should healthcare be connected to employment? We want to go back to the old company towns where the company gives you schools and grocery stores and everything else, like in West Virginia 50 years ago? Why should it give you health insurance? This has become, of course, this is in some ways the original German model. And again, this is sort of unquestionable. I mean, and this was, what, as you know, the Clinton's selling point. Don't worry, you don't have to pay for it. Your employer will pay for it. Well, it's like saying, don't worry about it. Your parents will pay for it. Now, where that money will come from, again, it's lost in this economic stupefaction. So until healthcare is separated, so-called health insurance, from employment, I don't think we can talk any sense at all about healthcare. It's all nonsense. But to show you how inimical to American thinking the idea that one should not only pay for one's own healthcare, and you know, I don't have to remind this audience of that wonderful libertarian adage that people pay for what they value and value what they pay for. But this has been completely inverted, both in education, as Sheldon has so eloquently shown, and in healthcare. The idea is somehow that these are two things that are extremely important, but we shouldn't pay a penny for it. Now, somebody suggested, apropos of the abortion problem, that maybe this is something that should be paid for by private insurance. And I happened to come across one of our leading politicians' comment on this. And I will just first say what this person said, and then I will identify the person, unless you can identify this person yourself. The answer to this one, quotes, "We are totally opposed to women getting private insurance for their private parts." I mean, if this isn't communist rhetoric, I don't know what is. What's wrong with private insurance for private parts or any other parts? This was Congresswoman Patricia Schroeder. Now let's go back a little bit to the history. And let me read to you what our great benighted President Franklin Delano Roosevelt said about this, who really launched this thing. Now, actually, the origin of this problem, and I describe this in my book, Our Right to Drugs, and there's a large literature on this. As I see it, the origin of this, as Milton Friedman pointed out, the origin of this problem of the politicization of health goes back to medical licensure. But even more, I would say, because medical licensure obviously is an indefensible kind of a restraint of trade, but even more to prescription drug laws. Prescription drug laws, I think, is the beginning of the end, in some ways, of freedom in this country, in that it is a leading wedge of telling the American people, you are too stupid to determine what to put into your own mouth. Now, if you are too stupid, then we'll tell you. And it begins with opium for Chinese immigrants, and it ends with cholesterol or wherever. Now let's see how this started, or sort of got its momentum. It was already in motion, but it was very languid. In 1940, one of the things which Roosevelt did, which is very little remembered perhaps, is that he dedicated the National Institutes of Health, not far from here, in Bethesda. And at the dedication of the NIH, Roosevelt said the following, quotes, I should have read this first because it certainly sounds more like Hitler or Mussolini. We cannot be a strong nation unless we are a healthy nation. And so we must recruit not only men and materials, but also knowledge and science in the service of national strength. The ramparts we watch must be civilian in addition to military. End of quote. So like in Italy, Germany, and the Soviet Union, it was time for American medicine to cease serving the interests of the patient and begin to serve the interests of, quote, national strength. 23 years later, Kenneth Arrow, Nobel laureate in economics, declared, quote, it is general social consensus that the laissez-faire solution for medicine is intolerable. This year, in the prestigious Shattuck Lecture, Bernardine Healy, the former head of NIH, who recently resigned, hailed Roosevelt's medical patriotism and proudly proclaimed, quotes, in fulfilling its mission, the National Institute of Health is quintessentially political, but we hope it embodies politics at its best, the use of public resources and power for the public good. By seeking to intervene between our fellow creatures and their suffering or death, the National Institute of Health is our most authentic answer to the question of our humanity. There you got it. Not one word about doctors or patients or the doctor's duty to the patient or the patient as an individual. Now let me run through why there is no health crisis here in a technological sense, in a correct sense. The reason why there isn't one, in other words, what we have is a problem of cost increases. Now, why has the cost of healthcare increased? I have listed, without explanation, they are pretty clear, 7 reasons, which are usually not, some of these are usually not that clearly identified. Now, one is the most obvious one I alluded to already, is the development of sophisticated and costly diagnostic and therapeutic technologies. Well, obviously, if you have CAT scan, it costs, as against if you just have a stethoscope, it costs more. Second one is the result of the success of medicine. There is an increasingly aging population beset by more and more and more incurable diseases. There's this idea that you save money by curing a disease is complete nonsense, because a person will get more diseases later. The economically most effective thing is for somebody to smoke a lot and drop dead suddenly at age 50 of a coronary heart disease, and he won't collect his social security, he won't get any more diseases. He has lived, he has been productive, and then he's dead. So it won't cost anymore. What would be even more effective if nobody gets born, then there are no medical expenses at all. So thirdly, and this I've emphasized, this is sort of my hobby horse, is a medicalization, a terrible word, but it does the job, the medicalization of life that is categorizing more and more undesirable behaviors as diseases, and now be careful, more and more desired behaviors as treatments. Several people have asked me, well, if somebody has, for example, quotes, a chemical imbalance, doesn't it prove that that's a disease if they get better on Prozac? Well, a lot of people feel better after they smoke. Sigmund Freud was a leading example. Does that mean that they suffered from a nicotine deficiency until then? You have to get back to what is a disease. A disease is something that a pathologist finds in the body. Chemically, visually, in whatever way. It is not the organism's response to a chemical, which is subjective. I feel better. That's a very nice anecdote. It's very important. That's why people do whatever they do. Drink, eat, get married, get divorced, have children, and so on. Complain about children, everyone. So, it all makes you feel better and worse. Every thing is that life, until you die, every solution is a new problem. Think about it. Every solution is a new problem. Now, fourthly, the transformation of the physician's role from ministering to the medical welfare of his patient to servicing healthcare consumers. Fifthly, the creation of a vast so-called health insurance industry. Sixth, the persistence of the illusion that we have a free market in drugs and medicine. People talk about private practice, drugs and so on, as though this was really available. And lastly, I put lastly because it's probably economically not that great, but it's very important ideologically, the escalating role of litigation in medical practice. And in listing this, I have in mind not only malpractice litigation, some of which, of course, is justified, but a great deal of it, like the verdict about the spilled coffee in McDonald's, illustrates a mechanism which seemed to me, I mean, again, I'm going to give you my answer to it, which seems to me so transparent. People keep complaining about how irrational this is. But I don't think this is irrational at all. I mean, you know, I like this old Shakespearean. I think Shakespeare was a very good, quote, psychiatrist. He said there is method in madness, which is another way of saying it's not mad at all, if you can figure out what the method is. Now, what's the method in these large awards, various awards? It's perfectly sensible. It's Marxism. Give, take from those who have and give it to those who don't. Except we call it tort litigation. Now, except for technical advances in medicine and the aging of the population, every one of the other factors is due to the government's involvement in health care. If the government was not involved in paying for CAT scans, and CAT scans would be like Lexuses, or expensive hotel rooms, or, you know, Mediterranean vacations, and people who can pay for it would pay for it, and people who can't. Now, maybe in the discussion period we can get back to, you know, well, what about, you know, should healthcare be really a market item? I'm not going to discuss that now. I have some comments here on two other subjects that I will just go by fast, and there is one is that because of the fact that health insurance has increasingly defrayed the expenses of the most trivial things, including medicines, you know, which may cost $5 or $10, which people could pay for just like for lottery tickets. But since even those are increasingly covered in health care, another phenomenon has come into being which shows sort of the hypocrisy within hypocrisy. And that is, again, I don't know how many of you notice this, but you know, why do we have prescription drugs? Well, the rationale is that these, many of the drugs, and this is all true, are chemically biologically very complicated products, and unless you're a physician, unless you know about pharmacology and so on, you really don't know what they do, so maybe you shouldn't just be able to go out and buy this, but go through an expert who will give this to you. Well, fine. Well, how do you explain the fact that all of a sudden a prescription drug overnight becomes an over-the-counter drug? Well, why? Because of economics. Because over-the-counter, then you have to pay for it from your pocket. Then the insurance company no longer pays for it. So now there is an economic incentive for making all kinds of drugs, over-the-counter drugs. Just to give you a couple of examples, and many of these are really imbecilic in the sense of infantilizing in the extreme, in that many of these drugs are still prescription drugs if you get it in an adequate therapeutic dose. If you get it in a dose which is so small that you really have to take two or three pills to get an effect. Best example is Advil. Advil is ibuprofen. Known in prescription, probably many of you have taken it. I've had a bad back. It's a wonderful drug. It's called Motrin. Now, if you go to a doctor, he will give you Motrin, which comes 400 milligrams, 600 milligrams, and 800 milligram pills. Advil is 200 milligrams. That's probably too little. Now, if you take two Advil, then you got a prescription strength Motrin. That's legal. Same thing with Benadryl. Benadryl is antihistamine. 25 milligrams you can buy over the counter. 50 milligrams is illegal. It's illegal. You have to get a prescription. There's a whole list of this now. And this list is now being increased all the time in order to get them out of the insurance scheme. Excuse me, let me not lose my... Now, the other thing I was going to talk about is managed competition, but I'm not going to talk about managed competition because that's patently an oxymoron. there's no such thing. Okay, now let me turn to the two examples which I want to use in my presentation. The two big diseases which now illustrate the problem of increasing healthcare costs and my argument about the government really being in an entirely new business, and I may as well point this out now, because this seems to be a very, very simple transformation which, again, let me sort of... slice right through it. Whatever you think of the legitimacy of the state and the history of this debate from Hobbes and Locke on, it makes a lot of sense to think of the state as some kind of a necessary, if you like, necessary evil, as this organization, this monopoly of power that has come into being by whatever fiction of consent or whatever. But historically, it makes some sense to say that we are going to forgo the idea of adjudicating wrongs and using coercion and power, and we're going to give this to the state to do this. To protect us from what? To protect us from enemies abroad, for which we have soldiers, and enemies abroad, enemies at home, called policemen. But it seems to me that in the last 30, 40 years, and now, with total abandon in the last 10, 15 years, today, with total abandon, United States in particular, it's as if the government has said, we have a new contract. We will no longer protect you, especially from enemies at home. You cannot leave the hotel in New York at 10 o'clock and walk around. You cannot leave your home because it will probably be burglarized. You will be pickpocketed, you will be assaulted on the subway, you will be pushed under the subway, and we are not going to do anything about it because that's not our business. Our business is to protect you from yourself. Therefore, we have to have depression screening because, God forbid, you might want to kill yourself. Back to psychiatry. This is where psychiatry came in. Psychiatry is a system which came into being in order to protect people from being dangerous to themselves or others. Now you know that this is the key law in every modern society. It goes back to roughly 1700 in England. It has an interesting history. Now this was a way to get rid of unwanted people who committed no crimes. I mean, here is this middle-aged or elderly or a grandfather or your wife, let's say, or you want to go about your business, and she's depressed. She doesn't feed the babies. She doesn't take care of herself. She becomes an embarrassment. But here you are at 1720, an English nobleman. How do you get rid of her? There's no divorce. Murder is illegal. This was a problem that Macbeth had. What is he going to do? Remember Macbeth? He calls for the doctor. What's he going to do with Lady Macbeth? I mean, here he murders his way to the pinnacle of power. He wants to enjoy himself. I always think of Macbeth as Lyndon Johnson. Lady Macbeth. But so what is he going to do? So he calls the doctor. And the doctor says, no, this is not a business for the doctor. It's a business for the cleric. And what does Shakespeare say is the correct treatment for depression? Suicide. Why? Because she's depressed, because she's evil. Now this is all gone. Now we have to protect you from yourself. It started with psychiatry. And psychiatry, mind you, again be clear about this. Psychiatry was very important, still is important. Psychiatry began, as I see it, as a sewer of medicine. This is how doctors got rid of troublesome patients. Now it's a sewer of society. What do you think will happen to this gentleman who shot at the White House this afternoon? Do you have any doubt that he will be seen by a psychiatrist in the next 48 hours? Now what for? Isn't it prima facie a crime to go around and shoot at the White House? That's very hard. What do you want to examine for? What are you looking for? His mental state? What does that mean? What mental state? First, the guys will come up with something. Why? To show to the American people that no, quote, sane American would want to shoot at the White House. God forbid, who wants to do that? And secondly, probably to be able to dispose of him for longer than the law would permit. Because I don't know what the legal penalty for this thing is, but whatever it is, he's going to be in a mental hospital longer than otherwise. See, when is Hinckley going to get out? Never. In a pine box. They're waiting for him to be cured. This is all legal. This is all not more than legal. This is the ACLU. Everybody's forces, except libertarians. And even libertarians, you know, this is a very hard not to crack. You know, this is what you do with crazy people. And I'll be happy to have some discussion about this. But that's why I thought I would take two examples of, quote, craziness, which are perfectly normal, namely eating too much and smoking. Now let me give you a couple of quotes, all from very recent. As you know, this has gone on for a long time too now, several decades. But now it's sort of getting greater steam is building up behind this. Treating overweight as a disease, a group of investigators, and notice that this is now a legitimate subject for the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. They are now studying eating too much. They don't call it that, of course. Overweight, I'm quoting from their report from July 94. Overweight is increasing in U.S. adults and continues to be a public health dilemma. Now, listen carefully, because there are internal contradictions here that I don't want to belabor. It's a public health dilemma for which no efficacious, practical, and long-lasting preventive or therapeutic solution has yet been identified. Please keep that in mind because of what follows immediately. Overweight, they repeat it, overweight is a condition known to be resistant to intervention. Nevertheless, next sentence, no pause, nevertheless, federal health authorities have targeted a reduction in the prevalence of overweight as a national health objective to be achieved by the year 2000. End of quote. I have all this referenced. Now, picking up the theme, the New York Times, needless to say, gets immediately on this bandwagon. And wringing its hand, it reports that the proportion of adult population considered overweight, defined as being 20% or more over his or her desirable weight, increased from 25 to 33% in one decade. So naturally, they go around and ask people what they think about this. A professor of medicine, whom I won't identify, at Columbia University stated, quotes, "The proportion of the population that is obese is incredible. If this was about tuberculosis, it could be called an epidemic. The problem with obesity is that once you have it, it is very difficult to treat." End of quote. A Harvard University professor, not to be outdone, has numbers for it. He has figured out that obesity costs the nation exactly $68.8 billion. No cents are mentioned. Now, how can obesity cost anybody anything is beyond me, but this is the New English. The government is not doing enough, stated Philip Lee, Assistant Secretary of Health. Finally, one more expert on obesity weighed in, urging, quotes, a President's Council on Diet and Health to be established, and a Democratic congressman rushed from New York promised to introduce legislation to create such a council. Now, notice that although the experts agree that there is no treatment for it, it must be treated. And compare this to the fact that the FDA won't put a drug on the market, even if it's used for 20 years in Europe, and even though the customers are willing to take it and take a risk, because they have not proved it yet that it's safe and efficacious. Unless you can prove that a drug treats a particular disease, the FDA will not license it for sale in the US. So in that case, they are over-strict. In this case of obesity, it's untreatable, according to their own expert, but by Bali, it's a government job to treat it. Now, this, of course, is all nothing compared to smoking. And I have several quotes here, most of which I will probably not bore you with. But the war on cigarettes has now escalated to such a point that several commentators have in the last couple of years compared the tactic to Nazi and communist tactics. And one of the ones that I like the best, and I will quote this, is a comment that Florence King wrote, who I think, in my opinion, is probably the best humorist now in this country, best satirist, writing in a National Review. Now, without mentioning where she got this from, and I suppose most of you, all of you, will recognize it, let me just read to you what she wrote. Quotes. When they came for the smokers, I kept silent because I don't smoke. When they came for the meat eaters, I kept silent because I'm a vegetarian. When they came for the gun owners, I kept silent because I'm a pacifist. When they came for the drivers, I kept silent because I'm a bicyclist. They never did come for me. I am still here because there is nobody left in the secret police except sissies with rickets. Now, this is a parody on the not at all funny lines attributed. I understand that this is not, no one really knows whether he said that, but Pastor Martin Niemöller said this about how the Nazis came for the communists and the Jews and so on. And when they came for him, there was no one to speak of. Now, the same, I won't read this to you. Probably some of you have seen it. Perhaps you didn't notice it. The R.G. Reynolds Company has been running full-page ads in the Times with several panels showing this, that they came for cigarettes, they came for this, and alcohol, what will be next? Cigarettes tomorrow. Sort of this civil libertarian. Now, you see, none of these people said this about marijuana or opium or all the other drugs. Now, Vladimir Bukovsky, this won't read either, he actually compared it to communist tactics, and he suggested, and he was wondering who won the Cold War, and whether this isn't Cold War number two, we are living through today, with a new breed of coercive utopians striving to alter our culture, etc. Now, what does all this mean? My reading of this is that this is all a part of what Joe Sobran was telling us at lunchtime with the following footnote, if you like, or appendix to it. That is, what has changed in the Constitution? Why is this totally different approach? And I'm going to put this to you extremely simply, but sometimes things are very simple. The moral, political, religious, if you like, and I'm not a religious person, so I don't want to parade under false premises, but that doesn't mean I can't share certain religious traditions or values, had a basic premise which it never occurred to them to question. And that is that they are dealing with other adults, that is they, the politicians, who were their, so to speak, existential equal, who were equal before God, who were responsible moral agents. Now, it never occurs to anyone now in the intelligentsia, in this medically, psychologically sophisticated age, that anybody who does anything wrong is a moral agent. Only normal people are moral agents. Abnormal people have something wrong with them. child abuse, alcoholic fathers, sex abuse, they have a neurosis, they have multiple personality, they're schizophrenic, they're depressed, and so on. They're not moral agents, and they will only be moral agents after we fix them, and we have to first turn them into moral agents. So and this explains why virtually all the ads, all the rhetoric, Mrs. Reagan exemplified this, is a war on drugs. She all the time talked about keeping drugs from kids. Well, who wants to hear about kids? Since why do politicians talk about kids? Who is keeping kids from Clorox and toilet cleaners and whatnot? And knives. We're not talking about kids. Kids are a problem for parents. We are talking about what adults can do. But there are no adults except the politicians and their psychiatric agents. This is the leitmotif. And Hillary and Tipper Gore embodies this. And the fact that I know that I am putting my foot in my mouth, the fact that these two people are women is not accidental, because women are the nurturing, caring ones, not the punishing ones. We don't punish anymore. That was Karl Menninger's famous book, The Crime of Punishment. Punishment is a crime. Crime is not a crime. That was a bestseller. You are laughing. That is now, look at DSM-4. Look at the American Psychiatric Association. Why would criminals be immediately asked to have psychiatric exams? If the presumption was there is something wrong with them, or else they wouldn't have done what they have done. There is no evil. But at the risk of putting my foot further in my mouth, let me show you how I see this transformation in, so to speak, religious terms. It seems to me our very concept of God and religion has become debauched. And I apologize if I offend anyone. I apologize even more if the point I make is not as good as I think it is. It seems to me that a couple of hundred years ago, and it doesn't matter whether this is 100 years or 200 years, not that long ago, let's assume that there was some natural calamity, like some sudden flood or avalanche in the Alps, which wipes out a little village. Let's say 60 people perish in this mudslide and water and whatnot, and three survive. But in the old days, I think a lot of people would have gone to church and entertained the idea that they ought to thank God for saving these three people, and that this is a very important event, but that maybe there was some element of divine punishment in killing the other 60. Maybe they were sinners. Maybe there was something wrong with them. This is now blasphemy. Now if something like this happens, everybody inside the television cameras goes and thanks God for saving the three people. The idea that the 60 died is not mentioned. Like in this case, obviously you can't sue anybody, except maybe you can sue some ski lift operator if he owns a hill. But that's not mentioned. What I'm getting at is that we now think of God as only doing good things, exactly like, quotes, adults. If they do bad things, they don't exist. And this is reflected in the kind of Gallup polls which ask people, do you believe in God? And 95% is yes. Do you believe in heaven? 98% is yes. Do you believe in hell? 2%. Now, it seems to me that this all makes sense, that we only have normal people, and then we have insanity, which we are going to cure. But we no longer have human beings. I mean, this Auden has also picked up. So among other things, then, what we have, since obviously people do bad things, what we have, although we no longer use this word, why do people bad things? And in old-fashioned terminology, and this term is still usable, because we have temptations. But we don't use that term anymore. These people have temptations to gamble, to eat too much, to drink, gluttony, fornication, and so on. We don't use these terms now. We have disease terms now, and therefore part of the government's job is to regulate the temptations and to protect you from being tempted to it. Don't be tempted by heroin. You can't get it. If you get it, we'll put you in jail for a long time. We'll tell you what to be tempted by. Lottery. Now this is extremely interesting because when I came to this country, thank God, before the war, gambling was a far worse moral and political thing than drugs. guy, you could get any prescription. You could get all the barbiturates you wanted as a lay person. If you knew the druggist, if you knew what you were doing, and you paid for it. Nobody worried about this. In other words, prescription laws were permissive rather than... There was no triplicate prescription. Nobody was watching the doctors, waiting to put them in jail. So it was a totally different atmosphere. There was no... But gambling, my God, that was a terrible thing. Now, gambling is sponsored by the government, hand in hand with a new disease, pathological gambling. Well, you know what that is. Pathological gambling is when you lose. It's it. Now, I have one other, apropos of temptation, what you shouldn't be tempted by, one other delicious quote here from very recently by a psychiatrist, naturally, Roland Griffith, a professor at Johns Hopkins, not far from here, who said in the New York Times, explaining these various drugs, quotes, "People think of chocolate and sodas as food, but a case can be made that these are vehicles for drug self-administration." Now notice the very word drug self-administration and the other English word, perfectly nice English word, self-medication, is now synonymous with doing something bad. Now you know what masturbation used to be called in the good old days? Self-abuse. Well, we don't have self-abuse, we have drug abuse. This is a very libertarian theme. There is only one sin in a libertarian philosophy, as I can see it. And that's in an anti-libertarian philosophy, that is to say. And that's autonomy. If you take care of yourself, if you control yourself, then you have no good thing. Because then you don't need the great leader, the protector. See, most of us don't need the FDA to protect us from heroin. We wouldn't be using heroin. That's true for most Americans. So you only need these things if you admit that you can't control yourself. So we are all back to Alcoholics Anonymous and 12 steps. The entire country, in effect, is supposed to say, as soon as it reaches 18, "Dear President, dear country, I can't control myself, please control me." Now, again, Winston Auden has satirized this particular social attitude in the following words. This is lovely. He is now talking about the caretakers. Quotes, "We are all here on earth to help others. What on earth the others are here for, I don't know." Well, believe it or not, I am finished. I have a concluding paragraph which I'm going to read to you. We have been traveling down the road to what I call therapeutic serfdom, to take off from Hayek, the therapeutic state. We've been traveling down the road to therapeutic serfdom for a long time, really, in a way from 1906, from the Food and Drug Law enactment, perhaps for too long to reverse course, assuming that there is popular desire to do so, for which there is not the slightest sign. "Liberty," said Judge Learned at hand, "lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. No constitution, no law, no court can even do much to help." End of quote. I think we must seriously consider the possibility that liberty has, in fact, died in the hearts of a very large majority of American men and women. And I venture to say that if that diagnosis is correct, the autopsy will show that it died by overdosing on therapy. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, it's only 9:40. So I'll be happy to entertain any questions on anything that I know anything about. So if you want to ask anything more psychiatric, feel free to do so, but you don't have to. No, I don't need this. Please, sir.
You had mentioned that there was no cure for obesity. In the last century in England, there was a gentleman who offered a medication for obesity, and he advertised it as being 100% effective, and it was. Anyone who was to take his pill supposedly could eat whatever they wanted in any magnitude and still, if they did, even lose weight, and it worked. And he was providing them with a sugar pill with a tapeworm in it.
What in?
A tapeworm.
Oh.
Yeah. Supposedly that was one of the reasons we got the Food and Drug Administration.
That's a good story. Well, thank you. I like that. I mean, disease is excuse. Anybody else?
Yes.
Could you comment on the work that people are doing in terms of trying to isolate DNA and other types of things like that to predict people's predilection towards certain behaviors such as drug abuse and alcohol abuse?
I don't know where to begin to answer that question because to my mind the enterprise is so patently fallacious. Again, one doesn't have to invent the wheel, it's already been invented. The way you identify the etiology or cause of a disease is by you first identifying the disease. In other words, it has to be something, somebody has edema in the legs, let's say, like from heart failure or, you know, possibly some stasis for some post-surgical reason. Well, then you have, this person has too much water in the legs. And you want to find out why. This is a physiologic, physical, observable phenomenon. Drug abuse is a name for a behavior. Now, by definition, drug abuse is not the kind of thing, although there may be exceptions to this in the case of alcohol or some other things, but by and large, historically, drug abuse conforms to the Mark Twain formula, quotes, "Nothing so much changed needs changing as other people's habits." Well, what is drug abuse? Drug abuse is what somebody else does. Or how do you, in other words, you can study the genetics or the biology of why tulips are black or white or red, but you can't study why they are beautiful. It's a judgment. There's no genetics of why tulips are beautiful. Now, drug abuse is a judgment. What's drug abuse? Are you with me? So I don't know what it is that these people are studying. Now that some people may be, for temperamental, personal, biological reasons, may be more inclined to drink, let's say, alcohol than other people, that's possible. I mean, there are all kinds of anthropological, historical comments about that. Maybe the Irish are more inclined than Jews, although that doesn't seem to hold up with acculturation and whatnot, with cultural change. But let's assume that's the case. From a social policy point of view, that would only mean that people of Irish descent would have to exercise more self-control because they are more interested in it. That's no different than some bibliophile is more interested in reading. They're not reading. Than somebody who is illiterate. You see my point? I draw an absolutely impenetrable wall between behavior and disease. Disease as a happening. Now this doesn't completely hold up. But there are some diseases which are more functional, but this is a very, very important thing to keep in mind. Behavior is behavior. I'm not denying the existence of behavior. Schizophrenia, paranoia, depression, and so on. Phobia, these exist, but it's names for behavior. Actually, in my very first book, I compare abnormal behavior to something which you can hear demonstrated right here in front of your eyes. Speaking with an accent. An abnormal behavior. Who is responsible for it? Me, I am. I don't have to speak. Okay, shut up. I could have spent my time taking voice lessons instead of writing books. I could go back to Hungary. So who is responsible for this? I can claim child abuse. My parents taught me Hungarian. This is a habit. A habit pattern. Just as identifiable as alcoholism or paranoia. A paranoid person thinks that people are after him. Very often people are, sometimes they are not. So what? What's next? It's a constitutional right. You have a right to be paranoid. You have a right to be schizophrenic. See, you cannot understand any of these things. This is, to my mind, that's why I think I was interested in libertarianism before I knew how to read and write, because it seems to me the issue is freedom. The issue is freedom from being coerced by physicians. But there are, in a civilized society, modern society, nobody can coerce you except policemen, judges, legislators, and doctors. Psychiatrists, not ordinary doctors. You can go to a dermatologist, with no matter what, and you can be sure that you can leave the office. You cannot go to a psychiatrist and be sure you can leave the office. And you certainly can't go into a psychiatric hospital where the door only swings one way. Now you're all laughing. But this is a phenomenon which has not been taken seriously and which I am convinced will destroy Western countries. Because this is an nobody can be in favor of craziness, of madness, or illness. So you people say, well, you are in favor of people being ill? How can you be in favor of that? Untreated illness. People say, SARS wants to deprive mental patients of disease. I already indicated there is no connection between disease and treatment. Treatment is something you have because you want it and pay for it. Most doctors treat non-existent diseases. Yes, sir.
I'm involved in two industries that are licensed, and in both cases, the licensing boards are controlled by the industry. Could you tell me about the AMA and their part in what you've been talking about?
Well, I didn't understand the first part of you. I can tell you something about the AMA, probably nothing that you don't know already. But I didn't understand the first half of the question about you are involved with licensing. Can you elaborate on that, or is that not important?
I was saying that my experience is that the licensing boards are controlled by the people they license. And it's the box.
Cutting. You know what? From a purely technical point of view, who else should be controlling it? In other words, from a purely technological point of view, I would not be that opposed. I'm not particularly opposed to doctors being in charge of determining what is correct medical practice. Who else should determine it? Politicians, or stockbrokers, or electrical engineers? There's nothing wrong with that. The question is, why should they have any political power? The American Medical Association is simply just another labor union that has swung with, when I went to medical school, there was no greater crime than group practice. I mean, even places like the Mayo Clinic were looked at as scans, because the idea was that anything other than a direct contract between a patient and a doctor and confidential personal relationship between those two, essentially a free market relationship, anything else was unethical. Now, of course, this was built on top of the fact that already they enjoyed licensure and the special privileges of excluding non-doctors, chiropractors, and so on, this whole competitive thing. Again, I don't know what to say about this except to read all of these things as we read the stock market, or as we read economic reports, or the symptoms of our own bodies. The fact is that, and this is where libertarians should keep this in mind, that freedom, autonomy, the drive for freedom is only one of the things that people want. Now, those of us in this room put this particularly high, but there are all kinds of other values that people rank very high, often much more highly than liberty, of which health is very high, security, dependence on authority. Now, most people like this idea that they can look in the yellow pages and every doctor is every other doctor, that these are fungible entities, that you don't have to find out who this doctor is and how good he is. So this phenomenon, this licensure, caters to that. And I don't think this is imposed on the people. I think this satisfies a human want. It seems to me, and perhaps I didn't dwell on that enough, that really the underlying problem is that there are not enough adults who feel like adults, that people are infantile, most people, and want to be treated as children, and this is the result of it. Now you see, I mean, people weeping when Kennedy dies or Roosevelt dies as though they lost their father. I mean, they should have been happy. I mean, I mean, because they're lawmakers. I mean, the implication is the more laws they make, the better, and so on. But this is, but they take care of you. I mean, if you're, the twain shall never meet. I mean, the question is, how do you look at these people? Somebody that you need to take care of you, or somebody who's bothering you? Now, most people look upon doctors in the EMA, and they're going to protect them from quacks. The fact that they are licensing quacks, that the whole thing is somehow the distinction between quackery and real medicine is best known in hindsight. You know, 50 years later, you can decide what was good medicine.
Okay, one more question.
Doctor, is there anything that you've noted in your members of the profession that makes you optimistic, either in the short term or the long term?
Well, I am no Pollyanna, but I am not totally pessimistic in the sense that the march of that science, civilization, knowledge, and so on are cumulative, are progressive. We know more and more all the time, and nothing can do anything about this. This is beyond any... This is, you know, the genie is out of the bottle. You know, just as soon as the hydrogen bomb was exploded, you know how... I mean, I understand the story of the hydrogen bomb, a Russian one, is that as soon as Teller managed to make one here and it was exploded, the Russians could tell from the fallout how it was made. Boom. So they didn't have to really spy for it, although that may help. So knowledge is cumulative, and to the extent to which you have more knowledge and more technological progress, doctors will be able to more and more for you, no matter what. Now, I am not all that pessimistic either, there is only so far you can push people. I think the intractability of the war on drugs, the very fact that we are engaged in this quest of building more and more prisons and so on, and that this is constantly in the news, and the polarization between blacks and whites that this has created, I think all of this may act as a corrective. After all, we are creating a race war with the war on drugs. Now, this is how we sow, this is how we will reap. Now, what the end of that will be, again, that may be a catastrophe, or it may be something relatively corrective, that we will see that this is something which was a stupid thing to do. This is a tiger that's very hard to dismount. It's a very, very hard to dismount. It seems to me that until we distinguish between two very simple English words, and this would be relatively easy to do, between, or three English words, two of which are synonymous or could be synonymous, the two good ones are cure and care. Okay? Now, the other one is coercion. Now, how these can be coupled is the problem. And we know now that the medical profession, as it has become more and more statized, is more and more in the business. It's more and more like psychiatry. Now, psychiatry has always been, people understood that, and this is also very difficult to talk about. Excuse me for taking a little longer to answer this question. See, when I grew up, things were relatively simpler, and unless you know the history of this, again, you'll be confused. Even when I grew up in Hungary, 1920s, 1930s, it was very, very clear that psychiatry was essentially like a jail function, that there were blue-coated policemen and white-coated policemen, and there were prisons in which you were locked up by the law, and there were medical prisons, psychiatric prisons, in which you were locked up by mad doctors. But this is a history. You realize that long before there was psychiatry, there were mental hospitals. Psychiatry doesn't start like medicine. The beginning of psychiatry is the beginning of mental hospitals. Then there had to be a rationalization for why people are in there. And for that, mental illness was created. That, in a nutshell, is the history of psychiatry. So this was psychiatry, okay? Now, up until the Freudian Revolution, and this is very interesting, civil rights and so on, I don't know if you realize that there was no such thing as a Jewish psychiatrist. Well, think of the great psychiatrist. Pinel, Esquirol, Kraepelin, Bleuler, Wagner Jauregg. How come there were no Jewish psychiatrists? Just like there were no Jewish generals. In Europe, a Jew could not become a state hospital director, which was what a psychiatrist was. These were state hospitals. Look at the terminology. This was a statist operation. Just like he couldn't become a general in the army. So then comes Freud, who is now described as a psychiatrist. Now, Freud was all kinds of things. He was never a psychiatrist. He never worked in a mental hospital. He never had a single patient who didn't want to be his patient. Psychoanalysis originally was what it would now may be called anti-psychiatry. Psychoanalysis was a contract between two people, one of whom paid the other for a service. And this is how the voluntary part of what we now call psychiatry came in. We have two kinds of psychiatry, voluntary and involuntary, which are exactly the same relation to one another as a prosecuting attorney and a defense attorney. Except this is now homogenized so that when you are in trouble out there, let's assume you are indicted for a crime, you think you are going to somebody who will help you, but you are going to a prosecuting attorney because they are not identified as which is which. And in fact, all psychiatrists are supposed to be now agents of the state by law. So this has become an extremely intractable problem. But this is how it started. This is entirely different. To some extent, this function of just talking to people has now been taken over by social workers and psychologists. But because of the legal understructure of this, this has now become very confused, and the entire mental health industry, as I see it, is essentially a statist operation. And in point of fact, to put it very simply, and you don't have to know anything about this except what you already know, I dare say, if every last cent paid by the federal and state governments for mental health were withdrawn tomorrow morning, psychiatry, psychology, and social work as we know it would disappear from the face of America. Thank you.
Just one moment of aside, while the type of things that Dr. Zaz was speaking about don't seem to bother many people in the political and social and cultural arenas in the United States, just as a footnote to some of his themes, one of the crimes of the Soviet regime when Andropov was made was head of the KGB in the Soviet Union, was the fact it was decided at some point that the only reason if someone would oppose the Soviet regime and the Marxian notion that history dictated a movement towards communism would be if they were mentally ill. How else could anyone oppose history? And as a consequence, Andropov came up with the idea that those who opposed the system had to be put away in psychiatric institutions. And while that was opposed by our medical profession, they seem not to have been much opposed when they themselves did that to their fellow Americans, just using different rationales as to what sickness was. The next part of our program is in fact the presentation of the Thomas S. Zaz Award for Contributions to the Cause of Civil Liberties. And the presenter of this award will be one of our speakers from today, Dr. Ralph Rako, who is a professor of history at the State University of New York College at Buffalo. Dr. Rako.
I'm very pleased tonight to be on the program in connection with the Thomas Zaz Award. As you learned tonight, Tom Zaz is really one of us. In fact, perhaps in more respects than you know, I have, perhaps like some of you, had a connection with something called the Libertarian Party. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I have been connected with that in the past. And in 1976, when Roger McBride ran for president, I was the chairman of the Libertarian Party in Erie County, referred to by some in the know as Boss Rico. And among my duties was to get together a slate of electors for Roger McBride. We wanted to have the most prominent people we could have, and we had some very nice people among the electors that were going to be officially on the ballot. And I called Tom Sawes and asked him if he would be an elector for Roger McBride in the Libertarian Party. And then, as now, Tom was busy at the totally full schedule, and he said, "Ralph, not if it has to take any of my time." Tom knows practically everything. Not that aware of the role of the Electoral College, I pointed out only in case Roger McBride carried New York, would Tom be obliged to convene in Albany in December with the other McBride electors. But we have, in other words, a person who's even been connected with the Libertarian Party itself. Now, you are unfortunately tonight deprived of the company and the presence of one of the great ladies of the Libertarian movement, Andrea Rich, the head of Laissez-Faire Books, and a wonderful woman. Because of personal reasons, a death in the family, Andrea could not be here tonight, could not attend our conference, and she was desolated. She was looking forward to it so much. A few years ago, when Thomas Sawes retired as a professor at the Upstate Medical College, Andrea had the idea of, first of all, holding a dinner in honor of Tom in New York, to which people came from many different countries. We received messages from the head of the Royal College of Surgeons and Physicians in London, distinguished people around the world. It was remarkable, and it was heartening. And there, another idea of Andrea's was to set up the Thomas S. Sawes Award in Civil Liberties. And I want to read to you the purpose of the award as set out in a few paragraphs. History shows that individual rights have been incessantly violated and are always threatened by coercive authority. That the price of liberty is eternal vigilance is a truth long evident to friends of freedom. Those exceptional individuals who dedicate themselves to guarding the liberties of their fellow man against the encroachment of the state deserve our recognition and our gratitude. For more than three decades, Thomas S. Sawes, that was then, has distinguished himself as the preeminent defender of individual rights in the fields of psychiatry and psychology. In this effort, he has had to brave both the current of the times and the pressures of a profession oriented towards power. He has remained the steadfast champion of the values of private property and voluntary exchange, the rule of law, and the open society. Uncompromising in his classical liberal beliefs, Thomas Sawes has been ready, indeed eager, to do battle with massive and entrenched establishments. That's an understatement. His struggle on behalf of civil liberties has been indefatigable, sustained over a lifetime of brilliant intellectual accomplishment. It is only just, therefore, that an effort be made to perpetuate the work of Thomas Sawes by recognizing and honoring those who follow in his footsteps. The Thomas S. Sawes Award is a tribute conferred annually on a person or organization, American or foreign, judged to have contributed in an outstanding degree to the cause of civil liberty. In this way, it is hoped that in years to come, fighters in the cause of man versus the state will find an encouragement to persevere. It is understood, however, that the greatest encouragement they could find is in the life of Thomas Sawes himself. Now, a fund was set up that generates a small award of $1,000 each year, and a plaque, plaque symbolizing human striving and human freedom, was designed, a copy of that also given to the winner each year. The previous winners last year was Richard Watts for carrying on a professor at Townsend College for carrying on SARS's attack on the medicalization of life, making the world into a hospital. The year before that, Richard Epstein of the University of Chicago, primarily for his book Forbidden Grounds, The Case Against Employment Discrimination Laws. And the first 1991 prize was to the late Carl Hess for a lifetime and a whole career dedicated to promoting civil liberties. The winner in 1994 is Lord Peter Bauer. And I will briefly explain the reasoning of the nominating committee. I think many of you are familiar with Peter Bauer and his work. He is the foremost development economist on our side. Born in Hungary in 1915. Oh, another Hungarian here. What a coincidence. In fact, a high school mate of Tom's. Bauer became a fellow of Gonville and Caius College in Cambridge from 1946, and a professor of economics at the University of London, the London School of Economics from 1960 until his retirement in 1983. In 1983, he was elevated to the peerage as Baron Bauer of Market Ward in the city of Cambridge by Margaret Thatcher. As a pioneer in the libertarian analysis of economic development, you read Bauer's works, his emphasis is always on the individual. His emphasis is always on the individual and the institutions generated by individuals acting in voluntary cooperation that further economic growth. But he has a particularly moral approach to economic growth, so it goes way beyond anything that's done by the establishment or mainstream economists in this way. For him, society can prosper in the long run only if the rule of law is established, if there's a respect for the individual, the rights of individuals, the freedom of individuals, and above all, the basic right without which there is no other right, the right to private property. It's on this basis that we are very pleased, the committee is very pleased, to award Lord Bauer the 1994 Thomas S. Sars Award in Civil Liberties. Lord Bauer, who lives in London, was not able to be here tonight. He has, however, provided us with an acceptance speech, and I believe that Sheldon Richman is in the audience and will read that speech to you. Thank you.
Lord Bauer was in the United States the week before last to, among other things, speak at the Cato Institute, but unfortunately he could not extend his stay. But he did send the following message. In the very early days of the persecutions of Christians, the Emperor Nero announced that on the next Sunday a Christian would be thrown to a lion. This created a sensation. A huge crowd congregated at the Colosseum, which was filled to capacity with ticket touts operating right and left. At the appointed time, a Christian was placed into the arena, and a ravenous lion let loose on him. The lion made straight for the Christian. Then an astonishing thing happened. The Christian turned to the lion and said something, whereupon the lion crawled away with his tail between his legs. The emperor called the Christian before him. If you tell me how you stopped him, I will let you free. The Christian answered, when the lion was getting very near, and I felt his hot, stinking breath, and saw his fierce fangs, I said to him, after the banquet, there will be speeches. This so frightened the lion that he ran away. From what I hear, you are much more courageous than Nero's lion and have remained seated in the face of the daunting prospect of an acceptance speech. I shall try to reward you by being brief. The maxim that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance is so familiar that it has become hackneyed. The original version, which dates from 1790, is much more arresting. It goes as follows. The condition upon which God hath given liberty to man is eternal vigilance, which condition, if he break, servitude is at once the consequence of his crime and the punishment of his guilt. Close quote. The implications of this maxim apply widely and forcefully to the contemporary scene. That this is so is ignored by a widely prevalent but unwarranted complacency about the prospects of personal freedom in the U.S. and elsewhere. This complacency has been encouraged by the collapse of Soviet communism, the demise of colonialism, and the spread of the market economy. Yet the complacency is unwarranted and dangerous. While the value of free markets and limited government becomes more and more apparent in the world, the willful promotion of aggrandized government in the West becomes more and more brazen. It remains now to be seen if we can overcome the inherent tendency in democracies to vote for privilege and benefits rather than for individual liberty and responsibility. How can we exercise the vigilance which is the condition and price of liberty? If we keep our eyes and ears open, we can contribute significantly to the vigilance required for a free society and personal freedom. We can find like-minded people in the media, the academies, in politics, whose prospects can be significantly enforced by moral or relatively modest financial support. And we can persuade others to promote voluntary association for the solution of social problems and thereby obviate their real or pretended need for state action. This vigilance, which is the demanding condition of liberty, not only avoids servitude, but gains its own rewards. Such rewards are the work of Thomas Szasz. To receive a prize named after such a courageous and original man as Thomas Szasz, and sponsored by such a capable, principled, and effective woman as Andrea Rich, is a signal honor and a great pleasure. So I thank you on behalf of Lord Bower.
Without the support of the people who have assisted us for the last 5 years, there is no way that the Future Freedom Foundation would even be in existence. And to you in the audience who have done that, we express our sincerest gratitude. Without the generous assistance of three particular people, one of whom is the Eugene B. Casey Foundation, that gave us a $10,000 grant to start this, the planning for this event, and without the generous assistance of two other people, this event would not have been possible, and I'd like to acknowledge their assistance to help put this event together. That concludes our program for the evening. I thank you again, and if you would just remain seated for just a few minutes, we will adjourn at the end of the final program.